Chapter 5. The Run-Up. By the time the public really focused on it, the decision to go to war had been made, though more through drift than through any one meeting. In September 2002, word began to circulate inside the military that an invasion of Iraq was inevitable and the march to war began. On September 9th, General Franks briefed the Joint Chiefs of Staff on the state of the war plan. The military was beginning to move, laying the groundwork by expanding the ramp space at airports in the Persian Gulf and upgrading key gear, such as special operations helicopters. 2 days later, on the first anniversary of 9/11, more than 36 senators were invited to the Pentagon for a briefing by Rumsfeld on weapons of mass destruction. One of those attending, Senator Max Cleland of Georgia, was surprised to find Vice President Cheney and CIA Director Tenet also waiting there. "It was pretty clear that Rumsfeld and Cheney are ready to go to war," Cleland wrote later that day in a note to himself. "They have already made the decision to go to war, and to them that is the only option." Cleland had lost 3 limbs as a 1st Cavalry Division soldier in Vietnam in 1968, and was worried about Iraq becoming a similar mess. His note concluded, "Our country is divided at this point, and God knows what will happen." The next day, President Bush addressed the UN General Assembly for 26 minutes, most of them devoted to a description of Iraq as a grave and gathering danger. He explained his feeling of urgency. "With every step the Iraqi regime takes toward gaining and deploying the most terrible weapons, our own options to confront that regime will narrow." And if anyone didn't get the point, the administration also issued a document titled "The National Security Strategy of the United States of America" that formalized the preemption doctrine which the president had outlined in a speech at West Point in June. "We cannot let our enemies strike first," it stated. "The overlap between states that sponsor terror and those that pursue WMD compels us to action. To forestall or prevent such hostile acts by our adversaries, the United States will, if necessary, act preemptively." Congress wasn't looking for a fight with the president. The National Intelligence Estimate, in its full 92-page classified form, contained a host of doubts, caveats, and disagreements with Bush's assertions. Copies of that long form of the NIE were sent to Capitol Hill, where they sat in 2 vaults under armed guard. Yet only a handful of members of Congress ever read more than its 5-page executive summary. Delving into the dissent in the intelligence community would only have gotten a politician on the wrong side of the issue with the president. Many months later, after the U.S. military invaded Iraq, White House officials would disclose that neither Bush nor Rice had read the entire NIE. The congressional vote itself, authorizing President Bush to attack Iraq, was anticlimactic. When the House debate began, there was just 1 reporter in the press gallery. The exchanges on the Senate floor offered little of the memorable commentary seen in the 2 other most recent congressional debates on whether to go to war, in 1991 and in 1964, regarding the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. The outcome, lopsided support for Bush's resolution, was preordained, wrote the Washington Post's Dana Milbank. Republicans were going to support the president and their party, and Democrats wanted to move on to other issues that would help them more in the midterm elections that at that point were just 3 weeks away. Ultimately, 77 of 100 senators and 296 of 435 House members voted to authorize the president to use the armed forces of the United States as he determines to be necessary and appropriate in order to defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq. The majority of House Democrats voted against the war, but in the Senate, 29 Democrats backed the Bush administration's stance, while 21 voted against it.